This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Karim Rastan, this week we have one of the founding fathers of a bit of culture.
I love that.
Well, you are.
A germinal, seminal, I love those words. Yeah, founding, always a pleasure to be here, Karim.
Sharad Kooten. And we have returning our American correspondent, the man on the inside, teacher, theatre exponent, Ray Bruno.
Yes, good to be here again. And as usual, you want me to hover around the Republican Party, the American elections, and all that.
Right.
I'm happy to do that.
It's kind of in the news, so good timing. So our three topics this week will be, topic number one is Bob Dylan and the winning of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Topic number two is Dario Fo, the actual death of. and finally, the actual death again of the Republican Party in America. So with topic number one, you folks may have just heard that the singer, Bob Dylan, won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And he's a singer.
Well, no, he's more than a singer. He's a singer-songwriter, and I think that's the distinction. So it's not for his voice. It clearly sounds like, treacle on sandpaper or something akin to it.
I think David Bowie called it like a voice and sand and glue.
Sand and glue. Okay, yeah. That's even worse, right?
Yeah.
But so it's not his voice. It's actually his lyrics, the fact that his oeuvre, his body of work has contributed to reshaping the very sound of American popular music, I think. And at least that would be the claim, right?
But music,
and in fact, world music.
Yeah, but music is not literature. I mean, you two, both of you, are fans of Bob Dylan, are you not?
I think Sharad is probably more of a fan than I am.
But you were.
But
back
I
in the
was,
day.
And I think at a very crucial part of my life, Bob Dylan's presence and Bob Dylan's songs and lyrics shaped a lot of my views.
Yeah, I mean, similarly for me. I mean, I grew up at a slightly different time in the 80s when Bob Dylan, in some sense, was past his prime, where you know the peace movement in the U.S. and all that he was caught up in. Had passed, and he was going through his own sort of personal evolution. I think he was a born again Christian at some point. He was a born again Jew at some point, and then he was post everything. And you know, he went from the kind of folksy acoustic background that he'd come from, and he'd moved into the electric guitars. Some people said he had betrayed them, you know, that musical tradition. And he moved a lot.
Yeah,
but I love the music. I love the lyrics. Some of it were non sequiturs. I don't care.
I know, but is it literature, or should we be making these distinctions?
Well,
I think it is literature for a number of reasons, and one of them is that it comes from a very powerful literary tradition in the United States. I think Bob Dylan was the first singer-songwriter to really assume the mantle of Walt Whitman and Allen Ginsberg, the Beep generation, and he brought that into his music. So if you look at the lyrics, especially the ones that I'm fond of, like The Times They Are A-Changing or Mr. Tambourine Man or A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall
or Idiot Wind.
You're talking about the same kinds of things that Ginsberg was talking about and writing about in Howl.
Yeah. So it's like poetry, but set to music, right? Mm. Poetry has its musicality. You can talk about the musicality of poetry. And poetry, if a poet had won the Nobel Prize, that would not have been a problem.
No.
You know, somebody who writes in essentially a prose writer, it wouldn't be a problem. A playwright wins. Dario Fo, we're going to be talking about him shortly. He was a playwright. That's not a problem. So what would be the problem with a singer-songwriter? Lyrics set to music. Is the music the one thing that would somehow disqualify you? What if somebody, you know, what about the librettos of the great, you know, opera composers?
Homer was a poet,
right,
and a musician.
Right. So, you know, so I think in some sense, there's a strong argument for his inclusion, or the inclusion of his class of people, singer-songwriters. Whether you think Dylan is worthy of the Nobel? Okay, that's another question.
But I think, you know, the word literature is elevated and rarefied. I mean, we don't call it fiction or storytelling. We call it literature.
I think also you have to, you know, bring into effect here the invention of the printing press.
Mm.
where suddenly there was a bifurcation between literature, which is on a page and distributed by publishers, and music or theater, for that matter, which may also be on a page, but is distributed in live performance or on recordings. But again, before the printing press, I don't think you make that distinction. There were medieval troubadours. There was the Ring of the Nibelung. There were all these.
Yeah, and you know, there's another thing. I mean, you say he's not a storyteller. A lot of his songs are storytellers.
Yes.
He's telling stories, literally. And you know that he comes from a tradition, and he's, I think, influenced by Woody Guthrie, was it? Or Arlo Guthrie?
Yeah.
And, you know, and they were major stories. I mean, one of my favorite songs, I think it's Woody Guthrie, I can't remember. Is Alice's Restaurant.
Arlo Guthrie. Yeah.
Which is a brilliant story.
Absolutely.
It's a brilliant story, and it's a very long song, And I think it's also the fact that Dylan captured the spirit of his times. I mean, whatever happened post, you know, the 60s, he was a lyricist. I mean, do you remember that there's this movie, Inside Llewellyn?
David.
There's a Llewellyn in there.
Yeah,
well.
There's a Llewellyn something, right?
Yeah.
And it's a cusp. It's a kind of Dylan-esque character, you know, coming at a time when music was changing, musical tastes were changing.
That brings me to my own personal story, which is that the first time I heard the name Bob Dylan was the week I graduated from high school in 1963. It was at a Pete Seeger concert in Carnegie Hall, and Pete had become a hero of mine. And it was, again, right on the cusp of everything that became the 60s. And Pete at one point said, I'm going to introduce a new songwriter to you and sing a song from him. And his name is Bob Dylan. You've never heard of him. And he began to sing A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And this was the June before Kennedy was assassinated. It was the June before the civil rights movement exploded. And a hard rain did fall.
And Americans are so good at myth-making,
yeah.
Especially about themselves. Ray Votto go, right?
He was on the
tears, and I live halfway across the world and don't care much for America.
Yeah. No, but hang on. Can I ask then, so is this then the Nobel Prize for Literature goes to the 1960s?
No,
I think it goes to the man. I think the man clearly, you know, had a sense of words, of both politics and the personal, and so much of it, his songs about that. It's a mix of the political and the personal. I don't know if you care much. So you say we don't care much for his singing, but you know, so many of his songs were done by others. I mean, they did covers of his music because they were great.
But hang on. So I mean, outside of Bengal and India, you know, Bob Dylan is so much more famous because he was in the music industry, toured the world, and all that kind of thing. So
and I've watched him live in concert in Singapore.
I watched him in KL. But I wasn't. Sorry. Yeah, you were there when he was still, I don't know, learning how to play the guitar.
Newport.
Okay. Fair enough. PWTC, beat that. So in 30 years' time, is it gonna go to
Britney, a rapper?
Well, Britney Spears and
God
maybe one
us.
More time.
Well, not Britney Spears, but you think of some of the more intelligent, sensitive rappers, you know, whose lyrics are in fact poetry, performed, sung with a backbeat. Yes, why not? I mean, I think we recognize that. Why should we limit musical forms? I mean, why should we? I mean, the prize is only the prize. It's the thing out there that's so much more important.
Okay, right? So, well, then I foresee then that when Bob Dylan goes to collect his prize, Kanye West will go up first and say, yo, yo, yo.
I just want to see if he wears, the formal morning clothes
of the Swedish
Swedish Academy, or comes at a print shirt with.
I think the latter. I'm going to go with the latter. So, from one great to another, the passing of Sherrod, Dario Fo.
Yeah, well, you know, to be completely honest, I know very little about Dario Fo, except that he's Italian, that he's a playwright, that he was also an actor, and he toured for 30 years and working with his wife. But a reason why he's captured my imagination is because I saw a production of Dario Fo's Accidental Death of an Anarchist adapted for the Malaysian stage, and it was staged during the Reformasi years, and I can't remember exactly what year it was, but I know it was in the Tun Sambathan Hall or building
I believe all three of us saw that production.
And it was so powerful.
This is the Instant Cafe production.
Absolutely, it was Instant Cafe. It had Joe Kukathas, it had Jose Sulaiman, and it spoke to the politics of the time using a story that, you know, was quite old by that time. I think from, I can't remember when Accidental Death of Anarchist is, but around maybe World War II or something. But, you know, it was about political satire. And I think, you know, the fact that it could still speak to us, I mean, from a different place and a different time, is just a suggestion of its power. But I don't know Dario Fo's oeuvre.
Well, Ray, can I ask you, because you are not just Mr. Tambourine Man, you're also Mr. Theatre Man, and in a nutshell, can we describe Dario Fo's work? Absurdist, satirical, socialist?
You just did.
Italian?
A communist, if you want to add.
Well,
communist.
Okay. Communist.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think Dario Fo is a reaction to the whole political spirit of his time, especially post-war Italy, where you had the remnants of fascism on the one hand, you had a powerful communist movement on the other. Hmm. And again, this, in a way, is very much like Bob Dylan. His oeuvre, I love that word, is that how I pronounce it, came out of a political turmoil and a political system. And in a way, just like Bob Dylan, he was an itinerant. And he threw together very quickly performances and changed them on the spot to reflect the political issues that were going on. And I think he won the Nobel Prize, didn't he?
He did, in fact, win a Nobel Prize, I think in 1992. I could be wrong about the date. But yeah, so you have kind of Dylan, you know, in the ascendancy having won it, and then Dario Fo, he was in his 90s when he passed away.
Yes,
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just think that it's extraordinary that, you know, these men and women of their time, I mean, capturing the chief concerns in a language. I don't know how much that language played a part, because I don't know Italian. I wouldn't know how it would have been expressed. But its malleability, its function as a tool, as a weapon, like the idea that art is a weapon.
Well, agitprop, I believe.
Yeah, but you know, it was too clever to be agitprop. I think it was, you know, you could say that it had a propaganda effect in the sense that it really was attacking the power elite or whatever. But it wasn't propaganda in the sense, I didn't think it made you stupid. It make you passive and stupid. It really was forcing you to think critically, because it used irony, you know, in much of its as a tool.
Well, can I ask though? I mean, if we bear in mind Ray's seminal Pete Seeger singing the Bob Dylan song moment. So Dario Fo was very much an activist, but his plays, fun as they were, and Bob Dylan's songs, fun as they are, did they change anything? Do they change anything? I mean, Dario Fo wanted to make change. Does it matter if it didn't actually make any change? Or does watching The Accidental Death of an Anarchist, did that change
it? Very quickly, there's another Italian that probably should be invoked at this point in time. It's Antonio Gramsci. Hmm. And Gramsci's own idea of change, right? It's not... So, I mean, it depends on what you mean by change. But with Gramsci, who's a theoretician, he was a communist, a member of the Communist Party, he was a Marxist. For him, he recognized that much of power resides in the way we speak about the world. So he theorized common sense. And I think the power of popular culture is it changes our way of approaching the world in common sense. So our common sense and the transformation of common sense... and our defaults and our assumptions about the world, that's where the change happened. And I'm sure they contributed. Maybe we can't pin it down, but they surely did.
I hope we can never pin it down. I really do. Because I think, well, when any artist approaches his art or his stage, he's not a polemicist. A great artist is polemical, but not a polemicist. And I think what he's trying to do is to bring people into a space and create something that entertains them and gets them to think and maybe leave the theater just a tiny bit different than when they came in.
That's the best that can be hoped for.
Well, I don't know, and I don't think that's worth not hoping for.
Hmm.
I don't think Brecht changed Europe or changed America with his plays, and he wanted to more than any artist I can think of.
Yeah, and it's also a question of what you mean by change. So there's the incremental, the accretion, the layering of, you know, change, right? Little bits and pieces there. But then there are these moments, and it's at these moments where things come together, mm-hmm. it's much more obvious who's contributed to what kind of change. You know, they led a political party, or they led street demonstrations, or they, you know, they shot in the Archduke or somebody and, you know, precipitated World War One or whatever it is. The point is the different notions of change. And I, you know, and I don't know, the 60s kind of peace movement in America really did have reverberations across the world, as did Gandhi's work in India shaped the thinking of Martin Luther King, who shaped the peace movement and the, you know, the kind of fight for equality.
And where would the civil rights movement have been, or where would the anti-war movement have been without the anthems? I mean, Bob Dylan's How Many Times became an anthem in the peace movement and the civil rights movement. So did We Shall Overcome. So did a dozen other songs that people sang when they were being dragged off to jail, right? Mm. And I really think that the music was definitely in that era part of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, none of which were written by Dario Fo, but still. okay. Well, Dario Fo, R.I.P., sad loss. And as somebody once said, the times they are a changin'. Mm-hmm. Is that polemical or polemicist? Was he when he was saying that? He was saying.
Yeah, I think he was being descriptive, actually.
Yes, descriptive. Yeah?
All right. So he was just merely just describing our times for us. Well, your times, Ray.
Yeah, my times.
Your times, yeah. So in a moment, though, we will come fast forward to very much our times with American politics here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Sharad Kutan, and Ray Bueno. And now Ray Bueno is a card-carrying member of America Land, which is in much turmoil. And one of the aspects that he's very interested in is the death of, he says, the Republican Party. Is this true, Ray?
I would say it's the unlamented death of the Republican Party, or maybe the not-so-accidental death of the Republican Party.
A bit premature, don't you think?
Thrown out of a window.
Actually, no. I mean, I think, for one thing, it's been going on for a long time, for decades, and certainly since the beginning of the Obama administration. One could say maybe since the Clinton administration or since the Reagan administration. But I think what we're really seeing now is the end game. And I think we're seeing a terminal split in the Republican electorate. And I think very much that's been highlighted, of course, by Donald J. Trump. When you think that the party started with Abraham Lincoln, how did it get to this man who is the opposite of everything?
I know. If there'd ever been a hot mic in a carriage back in the day, who knows what Lincoln would have been found saying.
Yeah, but I don't think it's the hot mic. In fact, what's really interesting about so many Trump supporters is they don't care about the hot mic. They don't care. Even the women don't care about his possible abusive behavior toward women.
Okay, but Trump and the Republican Party, or rather just Trump, has a lot of followers. But because of the nature of the Electoral College, etc., it's probably not going to be enough to win an election, this election, or indeed any forthcoming election.
Yes, that's true.
But it's been a sort of winning formula in the past, has it not? I mean, wasn't Bush's coalition of evangelicals and white people?
The history, I would say, goes back as far as Barry Goldwater in 1964. And I mean, I think one of the things that you have to take into account is the racism that's in the DNA of the American public and of American politics and of American culture. It was Goldwater that first, by speaking out against the civil rights movement on the basis of states' rights, and this is, of course, the way it's often done, began to bring the Republicans into a discourse where they were opposing civil rights. So you can go back that far. And of course, Goldwater lost handily. But that was began to be un.
So, and you personally would reject that. But just as you had your Pete Seeger moment back in there with Bob Dylan, you had a Goldwater.
Yeah, you there's would a, bring that up.
There's a photograph of Ray Bruno.
There was a hot mic.
Yeah,
so
you can't deny this with Ray.
When you were a Republican Party member and all gung ho for that.
And I was 13 years old. And I was rebelling against my Democratic father, who was a Roosevelt Democrat, and we had a picture of FDR in our house, and I had to do something different. But by the time I was 16, I was far to the left.
Far to the American left, by the way. But what I understand about American political parties, especially the two big parties, because there are, in fact, other parties, is that they're big tent parties.
Yes.
That's the expression. So they actually, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party actually overlap at some point, in terms of policy, in terms of outlook, and even language they would use. But it's somehow the shrinking of the Republican Party that's leading to its death. But it's also, Ray, and I just correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like the Republican establishment isn't for Trump. I mean, they have a very bizarre, ambivalent, now perhaps growing, increasingly hostile relationship to their own candidate. Couldn't the Republican Party, as somebody in some, on The Daily Show suggested, they are already producing headlines for the post-electoral, kind of news cycle, which says we repudiate Trump, that we never really wanted him to win anyway.
To paraphrase Bill Clinton, I think it depends on the meaning of we. And I think really what happened starting with Reagan's candidacy and with Reagan's inauguration is that by that time, the racist elements of the Democratic Party had become the racist elements of the Republican Party, thanks to the Civil Rights Act in 1984. 64. 19, that was a Freudian slip. And Reagan had been put into office by the corporate banks, by the corporations who were controlling the business end of the Republican Party. But he started his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was where the most racist elements of the South centered. That's where the civil rights workers were murdered in 1964. So why did he start his campaign in that little city?
So he was courting
the white racists.
Southern white crowd that is now Trump's.
Yes, I mean, that began, and that began then.
But they are now a smaller percentage of the American population than they once were.
Well, that's true, but they're...
they're getting older.
And they're older. Yeah, that's true also. But for a long time, all the way through the Bush presidency, you had someone called Lee Atwater and some of the others, political strategists, uniting the conservative, anti-feminist, anti-homosexual, anti-black elements in white America with the powerful industrialists, capitalists like the Koch brothers, who supported things on Wall Street, banking regulations, and smaller government. Let's not forget smaller government.
But Ray.
Yeah.
So that was once a winning formula.
There was a winning formula.
And it got Reagan and it got Bush in. But what you said the death of Republic. Why is it not now?
In fact, can I add to your question, Cam? What if Trump wins? I know that the numbers are showing Hillary pulling ahead in swing states. Some, red, as it were, Republican states are now turning into swing states because Hillary is actually doing well there. But what if the polls are not capturing the people who will turn out to vote for Trump and Trump wins? If Trump wins, won't that put wind in the sail of the Republican Party? Won't it just keep, will they say, that's the way to win an election?
First of all, it won't win. I really don't want to get into that topic too much because I think it's another show, okay? And hopefully it's a horror movie rather than
It would require all of California sinking into the sea.
Yeah. So what happened was, and I think this is the catalyst, was Barack Obama, because suddenly there was a black man in the White House. And suddenly you had all this uproar, the Tea Party began, and the Republican obstructionism of Obama and disrespect for Obama began in Congress. And suddenly there was the wrong colored man in the White House. And so this allowed people, especially bigots, no longer to use dog whistles. They could really use dog barks to talk openly about in racist terms. And Trump, again, took advantage of this and began to use the same kind of language against Mexicans and immigrants because now it was everyone could say it.
But my question remains, though, and it comes back to your original thing. How is that not a winning argument? How come this is leading to the death of the Republican Party? I mean, he won the primaries. He's through. He's still got 35% who want him.
Because it split the party between the base, which had always been courted and then ignored. So during the elections, the Republicans would play to gods, guns, gays, abortion, all those social issues that united the white base. But then they would run the country for the bankers. But once the Tea Party started and once the base became really activated, it's kind of like Frankenstein's monster. And all those pieces that had been discussed on Fox News were suddenly activated by a charge, and that charge was Donald Trump. And the monster began roaming the countryside. The people who had actually run the party and control the base, like the Koch brothers, they suddenly realized they couldn't control them before they could control them.
Yeah, yeah. But still, I think that if a future general election, a future Trump came along and said the same story about the guns, gays, and et cetera, and said, I'm with you, I'm your voice, et cetera, but just didn't say nasty things about Hispanics or indeed about, blacks you could still can, but about certain other things, they could win.
No.
No?
Okay. Well, okay. If we kind of fast forward, right, all these scenarios notwithstanding, what about the issue of does it really matter? So if the Republican Party dies or implodes or splits or whatever, what will it do to American politics? Right? Do you think it will have any effect on how America moves in the rest of the 21st century?
I think you have to look at the next generation. Because right now the generation that is supporting Trump is fading into the past, and in a way, this is like the ghost dance of the alienated white male and white female. So you have to look at the people who are the millennials and who are coming on board, and they seem to be much more attracted to Bernie Sanders, for example.
And interestingly, a much older white male.
Hmm.
I mean, they're attracted to a man whose demographic is actually older white male.
Hmm.
The same demographic you say is dying.
And I belong to, I might add.
And Elizabeth
and they're
Warren
also great
well.
White old men, though.
So anyway, so yeah. We must move on. But so you're saying that you think that America is moving on a path that you actually would find quite encouraging.
I hope so. But I mean, I think this all has to be put into the context of the end of this kind of neoliberal free market economy, which has not paid off for people. And whether they're people who support Trump or people who support Bernie Sanders, like people out of college who have huge debts for their college education, the promises that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and all those people made back in the 1980s haven't panned out. And it's happening all over the world, not just here.
Yeah. Well, it could be an encouraging future, or it could be the dystopian one that Sherrod is suggesting, which can happen if we look at Brexit. I mean, stupid can win.
Mm-hmm.
So we move on, though, to the final part of the show, though, we must, which is recommendations, and where we recommend something I think might be. I'm going to go first. So my recommendation is with the U.S. election in mind, which has been producing some really wonderful satire and comedy. The likes of Stephen Colbert, Samantha Bee, I recommended a while back, Seth Meyers as well. But I'd want to recommend one is the Saturday Night Live editions that have been coming out recently, where they've done Alec Baldwin as Donald Trump. Absolutely hilarious. But also the woman who plays Hillary Clinton, Anne McKinnon, who I'd never heard of before, actually. And she is so good, such a great comedian. I ended up just watching more and more of her, and I'm an absolute fan of this, and I want to see so much more of this Anne McKinnon. I think she's fantastic. So my recommendation is check out the Saturday Night Live clips, but also let's keep an eye out for this Anne McKinnon. I think she's wonderful. Sherrod.
I don't know if I've made these recommendations before, but so just let me tell me if I'm wrong. But I'd like to say, if you could have grown up on Sesame Street, that would have been a great thing. And I think that, you know, redeems America for me every time. But there's Deer Hunting with Jesus, Joe Badgent, which is a journalist returning to his small town in Virginia, trying to understand the white working class and why it continues to vote apparently against its own interests, you know, in supporting the Republican Party, in supporting big capitalists, in supporting an agenda that doesn't seem to be of any use to itself and its own interests. So, Deer Hunting with Jesus, one book. Tony Judd, who is a British historian, but wrote a book addressing the American public. It's called Ill Fares the Land, which is a brilliant book, making the argument for social democracy and trying to kind of engage with a country that doesn't have that vocabulary. Though I think since Bernie Sanders came on, started to speak of himself as a socialist, he's kind of redeemed. Because it used to be like, if you said socialist, you might as well have been advocating Stalinist policies, right, in America. So those two books alone, I think, might help you understand what's going on in the American mind.
Okay. You were raising your thumb there along the way, Ray.
I think the book that I would recommend now would be very complimentary to what you said.
This is your recommendation, by the way.
Yeah, this is my recommendation. Okay, okay, right. But it's a book called Listen, Liberal, and it's by Thomas Frank. And Thomas Frank was the author of What's the Matter with Kansas back in the 90s. And What's the Matter with Kansas addressed exactly the same point that your books, why do people in Kansas vote for Republicans when their economic interests are with the Democrats? And it was a very important book at the time. Now he wrote a book called Listen Liberal, and it's about how the Democratic Party became co-opted by the professionals, by the bankers on Wall Street, by the millionaires, by the Hollywood celebrities, and in a sense moved as far away from its base as the Republicans had moved from their base. So that the party that I grew up with, and when I said FDR's picture was on the wall, the party that represented the working man, that represented the dispossessed, that represented labor unions, that represented civil rights movements, under the Clintons became something entirely different. And I think one of Hillary's big problems is she tried to scurry back to the Bernie Sanders people. But she actually represents the interests that have almost nothing to do with the issues that the Democrats used to have something to do with.
Right, two words. Yeah. Wall Street.
Wall Street. I forgot those words. But no, I mean, Wall Street runs both parties, and in the Republican Party, actually, to get back, the split has happened, and the Wall Street Republicans no longer can talk to the base. That may be happening also in a different way in the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, none of these problems are going to happen in Malaysia because our political system is perfect, so we don't have to worry.
But there is a new book edited by Bridget Welsh, and it's called The Future of UMNO? You know, is UMNO about to die? So there's actually a book out there that looks at a dominant party and its future in circumstances that might not be so positive for it.
Choi, Sherrod. Come on, don't be silly. But quickly, sorry, Ray, that was, was it Listen Liberal?
Listen Liberal.
Okay. And so that brings us to an end of this edition of A Bit of Culture. Thank special honored guest, Ray Buono. You've done your voting, haven't you, Ray?
Yes, I already have.
Right. You're happy with your vote, are you?
I'm absolutely happy.
Okay, good. And Sherrod Kuzin?
Always the pleasure, Cam.
Myself, Cam Rastlan. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please do so on our Facebook page, which is a growing family. Like it. I think that's what one does, is it? Yeah. Producer Daryl's nodding his head. Also, Twitter feeds. Sherrod, you're still active, aren't you?
I am, at Sherrod Kuzin.
Yeah, he's Mr. Twitter. Ray, are you a Twitter kind of guy?
I can never get my thoughts into 140 characters.
Really?
It's an art. Yeah? Okay, it's an art.
Okay. Ray, are you Instagram, Snapchat?
No, my Facebook page, though, is very well known.
That's right. Yeah. Check out Ray's Facebook page. It's quite a meeting point. He says really stupid things that make me so angry. And so join us, please, next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.